Well, as you can tell, I've got part of a cold. I'm fighting off a cold, so it's a little hard for me to breathe. So getting words out is even more of a challenge. So I'm going to make you do all the talking in class today. We're on the chart in the workbook on page 14. We're looking at Mark. And before I get there, hold on. Go down to chapter 12, beginning verse 1. Tell me what you found. How would you title this? Parable? Which one? Okay. Wicked vine dressers. Okay, and at the end of this parable, what was the reaction of some of those who understood what he was talking about? Or who? Okay.
So when he finished, they knew that I was speaking in regard to them.
Yeah, they understood that Jesus was talking about them, and of course they're not going to like any time. I think Matthew's record in chapter 21, they got upset very much so that he would basically condemn them. Verse 12 says they sought to lay hands on him. Let's put that in plain language. What did they want to do? They wanted to kill him right there. And this is getting near the time that's going to happen, but not quite yet. But I'm sure that their understanding what the parable was about sure didn't engender any good feelings from them. But they needed to hear it, didn't they? Yeah. They had rejected all the prophets that God had sent, you know, their forefathers, and now that God had sent his son, and they rejected him too, so they weren't any better. In fact, I would say they're probably worse. Okay, what else do we see in this section? Okay. Jesus is certainly challenged in this section. We've got at least three different occasions here. The Pharisees, Sadducees, and scribes each are trying to challenge him in some way. First one here, we've got the Pharisees, Herodians, trying to catch him in his words, verse 13. And, of course, they come trying to paint themselves as genuine, sincere, and like a lot of false praise, they start off with this, oh, we know you're so great and you know all things. So how about this? And they're looking for some way to catch him. And the question is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not? Shall we pay or not pay? And if he said to pay, they weren't going to like him because, well, they didn't like the Roman government at all. And if they told him not to pay, well, they could accuse him of treason, report him to the authorities. They thought they had him in a lose-lose situation, but what was his famous answer?
Whose picture is on the coin?
Now, whose picture is on the coin? Render to Caesar the things that are Caesar and the things of God that are God's. Anybody ever watched the old movie Sergeant York? Anybody remember that besides me? It's one of my favorite movies of all time, just because Sergeant York was a very outstanding character. He was a man that was not very godly for most of his growing up years, but was converted. And right after he was converted, the World War I came to the United States, and he was drafted, but he was a member of a group that didn't believe in any kind of killing. And he had a struggle with that going into the military because he was told, the Bible teaches, thou shalt not kill. And he reasoned it in his mind that this was his way of rendering to Caesar what is Caesar's by serving in that capacity. And if he had to kill someone, he was famous for almost single-handedly capturing 227 Germans. And he think he killed 7 or 14 in doing that. And the superior officers, I mean really high ups, wanted to know how many he killed. And he basically said, I'm not keeping count of this because I'm not doing this to kill people. I'm saving lives is the way he said it. Because by killing these 7 or 14, however many it was, he saved, in his mind, hundreds if not thousands of lives. Because they had a machine gun nest that were just wiping them out. But that's going to be a challenge for all of us. I think at some point in our life, there's going to be something that our government asked us to do that we really don't want to do. And it may be like those of the day, paying taxes. Who in here likes to pay taxes? I hear some on the TV every once in a while, yeah, we need to pay more taxes. Nah, not me. I pay as little as I can legally get by with. That's my, go right ahead, pay mine too if you want to. But we've been given a specific command on taxes, haven't we? Pay your taxes. I know it's a challenge because what does our government use those tax dollars to go do? Yeah, fund abortions. Do I want my money to go to that? No. But who's going to be judged for that in the end? Me or the person who sends that money to go do those ungodly things? That's what we need to keep in mind. And so when we render to Caesar the things that are Caesar, remember you are doing your duty, and they're going to be judged for what they do. That's out of your hands. Now, it's not totally out of your hands. You can vote in people in this country, and you can choose people. And I strongly encourage everyone to think about your faith first before you go to the ballot box. And because there's too many people, I've met too many Christians over the years that are voting by their wallets rather than by their faith. And to me, I don't know how you can ignore your faith and vote for somebody who's in total opposition to what we say that we believe. So we can make a difference, but just remember that you do have a responsibility to your government, and God expects us to keep that up. Derek? Right.
And so, regardless of what you think about the government, the size of it, or whatever, we can't determine, like you said, can't determine how that money is used.
Right.
But if we rise up against it or cause some kind of commotion or refuse to show any sort of submission, a huge part of our faith is submission to God. So how can we expect others to see that in us if we don't show it in our daily lives?
Yeah, and we do have even specific commands about submitting to government. Romans 13, verse 1 through 7. 1 Peter 2, 13 to 15, actually through 17. That we are to submit to every ordinance of man is what Peter says. Now, some of those ordinances, now we're not talking about ones that go in direct contradiction to God's will, but I'll just use the one that we have to face every day, the speed limit. Now, I know I live in Texas where in some spots there's 80 miles an hour speed limits, and that's great. But in those places where it's 35 or 45 and you think it should be 75, I don't get to determine that. I don't get to tell the policeman, well, I know what it says, but I think. Because then the judge will tell me what he thinks. I don't have that right. And on top of that, as you're saying, Derek, I've got to be the example in everything that I do, and submission to government's one of those areas. And what Peter was talking about in that context, 1 Peter chapter 2, was that very fact. You are setting an example. Let's not use our liberty as a cloak for vice. In other words, our freedom as Christians, that we're really, we only have one king, that doesn't mean we ignore the earthly one. We still have that responsibility. And Jesus' answer here, getting back to the text here, totally against what they were expecting, I'm sure. But his answer was absolutely right. We have a responsibility to both, fulfill those responsibilities to both. Kim?
You know, one thing we all need to keep in mind when we talk about our country and the way it works is that we probably have the most influence at the local level.
Yep.
Mainly because the greater population just flat doesn't turn out. Your vote is normally worth between 5 to 10 votes at a local election level. So it's just magnified when it's not a presidential year.
Yep.
And we all just need to keep that in mind.
And, you know, even simple things like school board meetings.
Right.
You know, what are they teaching in the public schools nowadays? Do you know? Do you care? You've got kids. I bet you do care. And as Christians, I really hope you care. And, we homeschool, so we don't have to worry about that too much. I'm pretty sure I can trust my wife and she's not feeding them junk, but if you participate in it, that's a way for you to influence how things are going in your country. And as you said, on the local level, it's the best way to do it. And I would encourage every Christian to do what you can, but don't get so caught up in the worldly affairs that you forget where your home's at. I know Christians, too, that are so wrapped up in politics that's all I ever see on their Facebook posts, and I'm not ready to unfollow some of them just because that's all they're consumed with it. And which I think is too bad because I know there are lots of other people reading that, and you know, our first priority is not politics. But we do have a responsibility. That's all, we can leave it at that. All right, what's the next challenge? Okay, Sadducees and the resurrection, and excuse me, before we get into their challenge, what is their position on?
They don't believe in the resurrection.
And so what was their hypothetical situation? Excuse me. Yeah, this man married a woman, he died, and so she married his brother, and so on, until there were 7 of them, and finally she died. And they asked, well, whose wife is she going to be in the resurrection, if there was such a thing? They don't even believe in that. Again, how did Jesus answer? And think about that. Here's some of the religious leaders, and they're being told by Jesus, you don't know the scriptures. Is it any wonder that they got upset with Jesus? He didn't whitewash it. He didn't soft soap it. He just got right to the point and said, you don't understand the scriptures. He was right. And I want us to notice in Jesus' answer, and this is an important point, because some people today say that the only thing that's binding on Christian day is direct commands. Well, I want you to notice something about how Jesus answered. He quotes God himself, saying, I am God, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. Now, when this was said, when he quoted it, they're already all dead. So Jesus takes that statement and makes a necessary inference. Jesus made a necessary inference. Now, why am I saying that? Because if he said he used that type of establishing authority, then you and I can do the same thing today. Don't believe those who are saying that only direct commands are binding. Because Jesus read a passage and drew a necessary inference. And his necessary inference was, if God is saying, I am, rather than I was, then they still existed in some form or another. And the Sadducees were wrong. So, my point is, necessary inference is absolutely used by God in Christ. It's not an invention of man. I've read some books, seen some debates where some were arguing that necessary inference is human wisdom. Well, it's not either. It's to me, it's just plain old common sense. You look at something, you draw a necessary inference out of it. It's sense. Using your brain. God expects us to think. He doesn't have everything all laid out. He wants us to think. And Jesus took this passage and made a necessary inference that they had somehow missed. Sure. Sure. We can draw a necessary inference from that. Elvis?
I guess you wonder, after when he answered them, that they were greatly mistaken. If the conversation ended there, and there was more that was said but not recorded for us, but, you know, you get into discussion with people who are religious in some form or fashion, and then you answer them, and then they come up with, you know, the next hypothetical, ridiculous
right.
example. Well, what about this? And then yep. What about this? And you just keep going on and on and on with them.
Yeah, in logic, they call that the moving goalpost. So like you hit one and they move it over here. Okay, try to do it over here. Answer me over here and keep going on and on. I've had occasion to do that with a neighbor back in Arizona, lived across the street. I was out washing the van one day and he came over and started asking me a bunch of questions. And I answered every one of them. After about 36 questions, I finally stopped and I said, "What are you looking for? Because I've answered all the questions. How many more are there?" And you can't say that. There's no answers for this. We've answered all of them. They weren't even difficult questions. But he was supposing to, like these men, I believe, to try to catch me in some way and do something I couldn't answer. And inevitably, somebody's going to say, well, what about dinosaurs? What about them?
They were here.
Yeah, I can say they were here. We got evidence of it. But what's that got to do with your eternal salvation? It comes down to it. It's meaningless. And are we really interested in the truth? Were these men really interested in the truth? I don't know, these Sadducees, their question wasn't honest, but you know, we don't have a record of what happened after that. But what we do see is that one of the scribes coming and having heard them reasoning together, perceiving that he had answered them well, he had another question. Was he sincere in his question? I think in this case it was, just by the response we get afterwards. I think he was a little bit different. Because after Jesus answered him, verse 32, the scribe said to him, well said, teacher, you've spoken the truth, for there is one God, there is none other but he, and to love him with all the heart and understanding with the soul and with all the strength and love one's neighbor as oneself is more than all the whole burnt offerings and sacrifices. And Jesus said, you are not far from the kingdom of God. So here's someone that's a little bit different than the other challenges. But we still having these questions that if there was someone actually listening to what, say, Jesus was saying here, they would probably get a pretty good understanding of what he was all about. He wasn't there to win friends and influence people. He was there to tell the truth and hopefully point out the error of those who were misleading them. You know, these were the religious leaders. If this is what they were teaching and believing, where were the people? Might as well get right at the head to get to the problem. Okay, anything else in this section? Okay, beginning verse 41 of the same chapter, running through all the way through chapter 13. What's happening there? What's that? Okay, the end of the chapter there, the widow's... Has anybody ever seen a mite coin? Have you ever seen a mite coin?
It's like a penny, isn't it? In that day, it's akin to a penny.
Yeah, probably, I guess. It's basically if you went down to... In Arizona, we got a lot of copper mines. If you happen to go down there and find a piece of copper in its raw form, and you made a little wad... It's probably about a quarter the size of your pinky fingernail. That's a mite. It's a very, very small. I've seen one in a museum before, and they're, that big. If you lost one, you'd probably not even realize it and miss it. It's just, it's almost nothing. But yet, she had two mites, and that's all she had. What a great example, though. She gave more, Jesus said she gave more than all these others. And I can imagine Jesus observing this going on, the contributions. And I've heard stories about people who give in churches who make a before they put the check in, so everybody can see how that they're putting something in there. And I can imagine the rich going by the money box, and as they go by, make sure that they drop it from a high distance so it clanks very loudly when it hits the bottom, so everybody knows that theirs was a lot. And yet here this widow woman comes along and puts in two mites. I wonder if Jesus could even see how much she gave, because like I said, a mite is very, very small. But he knew. And he knew that that's all she had. What's so great about that example?
Well, one, she's fixing to go hungry because she doesn't have any more money to buy food or whatever.
Elvis?
Give the best you can.
Okay, give him the best. Richard?
Trust
in the Lord. Yeah, I think it's all these things. Here's someone that gave all she had. She's setting a great example by giving the best that she could do. And she was putting her trust in God. And it's no wonder Jesus would look at this example and say that she's given more than all these others. Because in a sense, she certainly had. That's a lesson I've had to learn over years, too. When I didn't make a whole lot of money, I didn't give because I thought, well, it's not much. Until someone told me, and said, well, God doesn't expect you to give what the rich guy over there gives. He expects you to give what you can. And I was chastised properly and got that idea out of my head. It's not what you don't have. That's not what God's interested in. It's what you do have and what you can do. And that's all we need to be concerned with. Okay, any other? What else do we have in this section? Warning, and what is the warning? Specifically of Jerusalem, right? So the destruction of Jerusalem. How well do you think that was received? Not so good. I'm pretty sure they didn't want to hear that. Because beginning of the chapter 13, one of the disciples is taking Jesus and showing him this great temple. Look how big these stones are and what a beautiful building this is. And then first thing Jesus says is, there's going to come a day where there's not going to be one of these stones that's not thrown down. We talk about deflation quickly, but it was a serious warning. You know, this was probably about 30 AD, I said it right the first time, and 68 AD is when the city was destroyed, by the Romans, besieged and destroyed, burned, everything was torn down. So in less than 40 years, that's all going to be gone. A generation is going to see this. Some of those who are standing there to hear him say that are going to see it. And they needed to know that they needed to choose whose side they were going to be on.
And this is what the false witnesses are going to twist.
Right.
Yeah.
He was going to destroy the temple. And he was talking about a different temple. Okay, anything else in that section? All right, next section, chapter 14 through chapter 15, verse 22. Okay, we've got the plot and the betrayal. That is a B.
trial, if you want to call it that. Why did they do things as they did with Jesus here? Why come in the middle of the night? Why have a trial at night? Why have the Romans be the ones who arrest him, or their officers of the chief priest?
Well, first of all, it was against their rules to have a trial at night like that. But they did not want other people to know what they were doing.
They were so brave, right? And even Jesus, when they come to him at night, was wondering, why didn't you come get me all these other times I was out there in the daylight? Well, the answer to that was obvious. They didn't want any opposition. They were afraid of the people. And so when they took him, they put him on trial in the middle of the night because they didn't want any people to interfere. And when he sent him back and forth, Herod and back to Pilate, it was all about politics. And they didn't want it done in any way where they would get any interference from the people. But here's the thing we need to keep in mind. All the way through this, Jesus could have ended it at any moment if he wanted to. But remember that he did all this purposefully. Elvis? And here's the irony in that. By what they're doing, what was the chief priest's duty under the old law that we just talked about last week?
Right.
The Day of Atonement, right? But what are they in effect doing right now? They're going to end up being responsible for that sacrifice that's saving us from our sins. So in an ironic way, they're actually helping us out by what they're doing. Yes.
And now they're coming together for a greater wickedness.
Yep. Well, that's what you get, again, when you have people that are interested in power and they just want to keep that power, just like the religious leaders, they want to keep their power. And these two men, they want to keep their power. And so now they find a reason to work together to win favor of the people, at least the ones in power. So it's really all about politics, the politics of power, trying to get that power or keep that power or to gain a little bit more power over the people. By working together now for this one deed, they're going to please all the Jewish leaders. And so then some point later on, they can go to them and say, hey, you remember what we did for you? So, and I'm not a cynic. I'm a realist. That's what's going on. It's all about their political power, because as you may have read in John the 11th chapter, after the resurrection of Lazarus, when the news gets to them, they get together and they're saying, what are we going to do? If we leave this man alone, the people are going to believe him and follow him, and the Romans are going to come and take away our position. So it was not really ever about truth or not. They just wanted to keep on their power. Derek? Yeah, they knowing they're not dumb. They're doing this in a evil sense, very wisely, about avoiding conflict and making Jesus. If they had done this in the middle of a crowd. Can you imagine the response of the people and how they would, how quickly they would have turned against them and turned on them if they had tried to do that in public? But if they can use the cover of darkness to destroy his credibility, you know, and think about it. Now, by the time he is at dawn and where other people can see him, he's been up all night. He's very beaten down. And now he's got all these official accusations against him, which, unfortunately, we tend to believe what somebody tells us. You know, look at him. He's in chains. He must have obviously done something wrong, right? They surely wouldn't make these false accusations. We like to believe that our rulers are all good and they don't do things like that. And so by the time he's in front of the crowds, now the ones who accused him are in the crowd and they're inciting the crowd. And when even to the point when Pilate says, "Who shall I release, Barabbas, this murderer, or your king?" And they've been incited, you know, by those amongst them in the crowd that who had put him there to begin with, and they start shouting out, "Crucify him, crucify him." So now that's the reality of how things can happen if we're not stopping to think about what we're doing. And these religious leaders, Jesus was to them the biggest threat to their position. Who was it? Will Rogers said the two things you should never see how it's made are bills in Congress and sausage. Because I think if we understood how the wheels of our national government worked, we would be very disgusted about all the back dealings that go on to get things done. We tend to see, as you said, this the end result or some of the talk in between, but there's a lot of deals that go on, and there's nothing wrong with working deals, but I see far too much of it that's for their own good rather than our good, our country's good. And same here. You know, were these leaders doing anything for the good of the people? They weren't doing it for anybody else but for themselves. Again, John 11, verse 47. If we leave him alone, the people are going to follow him and the Romans are going to come and take away our positions. That tells me right there what they're most interested in. And verse 53, from that day forward, they plotted how they might kill him. That was their answer. He was their biggest threat. And their answer was to get rid of him. Wasn't even about truth at all. Richard? And like Derek said, they're not dumb. They're not foolish. And we may think they are, and the end result, we certainly would say so, but they were doing, you know, they were thinking about how to do this the best way. Sure. Now, and that's the thing, that's why I'm all so cautious that we talk about being involved in politics, but not too much. keep in mind that, you know, as Christians, our primary focus is not this life but the next. But we should expect then that those who are focused on this world and just the things of this world are not going to think about giving an account for what they're doing. And if there is no moral background to people who get involved in this, it's going to be do what you can while you can, get what you can. And so, you know, we shouldn't be surprised for those who go into politics with absolutely no moral standards. We shouldn't be surprised what we get out of that. You know, and again, that's why I would encourage you, when you do your voting, think about not party lines, but who's going to be the one that, a lot of times it's a good guess, because politicians will say anything to get elected. Some of them will anyway. But why shouldn't we be thinking about what they're actually going to do and what they've proven themselves to do as far as leading us, leading the nation toward higher standards rather than lower ones? And you know, why shouldn't we be thinking about things like that? Politically expedient, I think, is the word we use today. And I've read enough John Grisham novels to see there's a lot of times where that's something like that's going to be going on in higher up positions, where someone won't even think twice about someone dying to get their agenda furthered. And that's the sad thing. Again, that's the world we get when we have no moral basis. If we start off with this as our moral basis, though, I don't care what you get into, you'll be a good person and you'll be a good whatever that position is. If we start off with no moral basis, then we shouldn't be surprised what we get out of it. And I just kind of chuckle ironically and sadly when I hear a lot of people complain about the world we live in today, when I know that about the time I was born, God started being thrown out of the public arena. And nobody likes to teach morals anymore. Well, what kind of world do you think you're going to get? It's not going to be utopia when you throw out all the moral standard and any accountability. And getting back to what was said earlier, you know, how could they do this? Do they not realize they're going to give an account, kings and rulers and whatever? Well, they don't. A lot of them, I think, just don't. But I don't think they're special people either. There's a lot of people in the common society that don't think they have to give an account either. We have to think about ourselves. Do we realize that? Realize we're going to have to give an account someday? This morning's lesson is God being a just judge. We're going to stand before him someday. Okay, let's see if we can finish out these last two real quick. Chapter 15, verse 22 through the end of the chapter. Crucifixion, and then the resurrection. And we could spend weeks talking about that, right? All right, we'll pick up with the text on the submissive servant on page 16 and 17 next week. Appreciate all your comments.